from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll learn about the last two concerts of Encore Vocal Arts season.
I'll find out about how the Metropolitan Youth Orchestra is celebrating its 20th anniversary.
And I'll find out about an exhibit of Booth Tarkington's art collection on display at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Peacemakers and the Crossroads of America are the themes for Encore Vocal Arts' final two concerts of this season. Sharon Gamble invited John Perkins, the ensemble's artistic director, and Tom McTamney, its executive director, to talk about the repertoire and special features of these two events.
So Peacemakers is getting a lot of attention, and I want to talk to you. I know my colleague Travis is having James Aikman on, and Ron Caltabiano's already been on talking about this piece, but I think it's appropriate that it gets a lot of attention because it's a gargantuan and very ambitious piece. Would you describe the format of it to us?
Well, Encore Vocal Arts is being hired as one of the entities in the group, and as well as the Indianapolis Children's Choir, a number of soloists, and of course it's being hosted by the Chamber Orchestra. So we are singing probably about 25 to 30 minutes of choral music from our side, although there are overlapping moments with the children's chorus and then children's chorus independent of the singers, et cetera. So we have had the perspective of the music that we've been given. It's about an 80-minute composition, from what I understand. Characters like Gandhi
Martin Luther King,
yeah. Right. A lot of the 20th century figures who were seen as peacemakers are part of this concert. It's going to be the choral writing is exceptionally beautiful, and James Aikman's done a great job. So
has he corresponded with you at all? I mean, is he the sort of composer who might send you some passages and say, try this out next time you have your choir in the room?
He and I spoke about it a lot last semester. He happened to be my hallmate at Butler University.
He was
replacing someone on sabbatical in the composition faculty, so we were able to talk a lot about it. But mainly, you know, he was telling me about the texts and how excited he was. So he's dropping by our rehearsal in a couple of weeks to really talk to us about those texts more specifically and why he chose them.
Wonderful. Circle back to, you said he's done some wonderful choral writing. What does that, define that for us? Why is it good choral writing?
It sits in the voice beautifully. It is melodic. You can sing it on your way out the door. To me, when the singers start singing it and they start crying in rehearsal, those are good signs.
Wow.
And so it's a very emotive piece. The text was very well chosen and then very well set.
Beautiful. Can't wait to hear this.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting.
So one thing that's a little mysterious to people who maybe aren't singers or aren't instrumentalists is how the partnership works. So you will be preparing the choir, but you won't be conducting the performance, right?
That's right. And in a typical choral orchestral situation where the choir, well, it just depends on who's, you know, who's paying the bill, essentially.
Darn capitalism.
But a lot of times the chorus master will, you know, prepare the choir and then turn them over to the orchestral conductor, who's who's generally the person on those bigger shows, those bigger concerts. And, you know, this happens typically and sometimes you know, it's the opposite situation where the choir hires the orchestra and then the choral conductor conducts. So,
sure.
Yeah.
So in those situations, regardless of which direction it goes, of who ends up on the podium the night of a performance, do you spend a lot of time being on the same page? Like, are you and Matthew Kramer going to sit down and you're going to say, well, I prepared them to do this here and I want to explain why? Or is it just the music on the page and the interpretation might change a little bit when he's on the podium?
Well, we collaborated back in December on the Messiah concert, and that was Even though it's, you know, an age-old piece, everyone knows it, there's so many things to talk about. So we were able to sit down, him being the new director of the Chamber Orchestra and me being the new director of Encore. We had a lot of catching up to do on that piece.
Sure.
So we talked about all sorts of markings, the way he wanted the phrasing. I made my suggestions. So it was a nice collaboration back and forth. And I'm sure that we're going to be doing that as we get a little bit closer to the concert.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Yeah. Tom, to whom do you think Peacemakers will appeal?
Boy, that's a really good question. I hope it appeals to everyone in this day and age, because there's so much violence in the world right now that a piece about peace, mm-hmm. I would hope would be appealing to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And what's great is to hear John and the choir talk about what a great choral piece it is. Hopefully it will bring in choral lovers as well as orchestral lovers. So a nice cross across all the lines of music lovers in the city.
And accessible music. And I'm sure there will be children in the audience, because they'll be coming to hear their siblings in the children's choir.
Or certainly parents.
Or parents, yeah, for sure. And grandparents, et cetera. And as part of Butler Arts Fest, you'll be exposed to some new people as well, with luck, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We attract a large and diverse crowd every year. So it's always packed out, you know, in the house, so you've got to get your tickets early.
All right. Word to the wise. And then your final concert of the season, I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about Indiana Welcomes. What is the idea behind Indiana Welcomes? Where did the idea come from? I'm looking at John.
Yeah. Well, as we all know, it's our bicentennial, our 200th year, celebrating the great state of Indiana. And as a newcomer to Indiana, I was interested in its history to know who are the people. You know, I'm very much dealing with human interactions every day, leading several choirs on campus at Butler and, mm-hmm. and with Encore, and very interested in the goings-on between interrelationships in the choir. And that made me think about what are the interrelationships we have with our community.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we engage the community, we find out their stories, and we find out where they came from and where they're going, hopefully, as well. So a lot of my initial stab at this was to almost self-educate, but also be able to have a moment to for us to engage with our past and our present. That's essentially how the concert is set up. We're going to be examining different historical groups that have migrated to Indiana over the last 200 years, and then the second half really take a look at the groups that are coming here now.
Mm-hmm. Remind us where's home to you? Where did you grow up?
Titusville, New Jersey, okay. Near Washington Crossing area.
Okay, so no stranger to immigrant populations through the years.
Right.
Anything in your research, since, you know, you're, again, a relative newcomer, what did anything surprise you about Indiana's past? About our cultural mix or anything?
Well, it's interesting. Some of the same debates that are going on today were going on back in the 1800s. And, you know, we have Quakers and Germans coming in with ideas about slavery and then other groups coming in thinking that it should be legal. And so it was an interesting kind of, fast forward to now and some of the same racial issues are still being presented, you know, with everyone every day, just in different terms. So that was interesting to look at and to think about Irish immigrants coming and really building the city and building a lot of the waterways and they're kind of, having sort of a very difficult time in their own land, coming here to look for something better and arriving and realizing that, you know, they're going to work for very little, but you know, they're the ones that almost really built this community from the ground up. So it's been an interesting look at the historical part. And of course, we have, you know, African slaves migrating to the north, to free states. We have the Jewish community coming from, you know, after post-World War II and even in post-World War I, mm-hmm. Out of Europe as well. And then when we get to today's groups, and even I could say over the last 150 years, of course, the Latino population has become been coming to Indiana. We have Congolese communities. We have Burmese communities. Even within that community, there's diversity there. Chinese American. So lots of different folks coming here, and it kind of just begs the question: who is our neighbor? You know, mm-hmm. And what does it mean to be a neighbor? And so those are some of the questions we're going to ask in the concert. I think we'll leave it up to the audience to answer those questions. But we're going to ask that to live humans who will tell their story of migration, you know, coming here from a different country, possibly out of conflict, as a refugee, or possibly out of, taking a different job, simply. And then also finding out, what is it that binds us all together through that experience? And I think the more times we ask, a plurality of groups that same question, we'll start to understand, in fact, who we are and what's between us.
The sociology and psychology you've just described is fascinating, and I'm eager to hear some of the music you've selected. I mean, were you able to find music or maybe you weren't looking for music that maybe reflected the xenophobia of a century ago? Did you purposely look for political music within a political climate, or was it more to just represent different cultures that were coming here?
I think some of those political things are can be realized more as a humanitarian look at what we're trying to point at. And I think it's awfully divisive to get into politics and this side and that side.
Sure.
The music itself, I found this incredible Syrian text that was written in the 1980s about someone who, he says, I'm paraphrasing, if I've lost my voice, you have a chance to sing. And he puts it back on the listener and he says, if I'm gone, then my music will live on in the hearts of those who need to be bound up together. Very, very beautiful. And it certainly, appeals to one of the hugest migration problems that will be this century, the Syrian migration and the Iraqi migration. So we have folks that are arriving from Syria today, and coming to the state and trying to look for a new peaceful place to live,
mm-hmm.
and a community where they'll be safe and they can raise their children. So that and tons and tons of African-American music, when we look at There Is a Balm in Gilead, one of my good friends, Issei Barnwell, had talked to me about this piece. There's a balm in Gilead to heal the wounded soul. There's a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. And it's really a reconciling text. It's the African-American community being wounded, asking for a balm, and then saying to the community that oppressed them, the sin-sick soul, there's a balm in Gilead as well. Hmm. Beautiful, beautiful kind of deeper meanings once we start to kind of peel back the layers of the text and why they were written for those groups.
Gosh, it's an extension of your peacemaking. In a way.
What I love is the fact that it leaves a question open. Is there really such a thing as Hoosier hospitality?
Mm.
And, we talk about it all the time. And how hospitable are we to all of these groups? And, eventually they all become assimilated. And then they become the ones that have to ask the question, are we hospitable to the next group?
Can we open our doors?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Say a little bit more about, so you're actually going to have a storytelling element, and Encore is kind of famous for doing something a little unexpected, not just singing, but making a more interesting texture than just singing. So we'll have some immigrants who will be telling their stories in between pieces, right?
That's right. Not everyone wants to be live on a stage, so we're going to be doing some videography as well, some interviews, and also going on the street and asking people those questions. Mm. What does it mean to be a good neighbor?
Wow.
Who is my neighbor? And getting just kind of raw answers, maybe from unexpected people who are not expecting to be interviewed that day, but to see what their reactions are and what that means to them, as well as, those one-to-one interviews of folks that are just coming here now. So that'll be exciting.
And we're also excited about where we're performing because this particular concert will be at the Indiana History Center, and we're working very closely with the Indiana Historical Society to help us with a lot of the the research and the history that will make this a success.
As well as the Immigration Welcome Center. They've both been very, very generous with their time and their efforts to educate me on all of those research questions.
Sharon Gamble with Encore Vocal Arts Artistic Director John Perkins and Executive Director Tom McTamney. James Aikman's Peacemakers with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra will be performed on Friday, April 15th at Butler Schrott Center for the Arts. Indiana Welcomes will be on Sunday, May 22nd at the Indiana History Center. And you can learn more and get tickets at EncoreVocalArts.org. Again, EncoreVocalArts.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The Metropolitan Youth Orchestra helps youth and families develop life skills through the rehearsal and performance of music. Students have weekly lessons and ensemble performances and perform in a solo recital each year, as well as many other concerts. What makes it unique is that parents can rehearse and perform with the students as well. Travis DiNicola spoke with founder and artistic director Betty Perry and MYO alumnus and new associate director Crystal Ford about how they're celebrating their 20th anniversary.
Betty, Crystal, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both here.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You are very welcome. And let me just start off by saying congratulations on your 20th anniversary. That's pretty fantastic.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So, I mean, Betty, I know you've been around since the very beginning.
Exactly.
Why don't we, before we talk about the upcoming concerts and how you guys are celebrating and Crystal's new role, give me a little background on Metropolitan Youth Orchestra, MYO.
Well, I established it in 1995, and we were originally at the Children's Museum.
Yeah,
and then later we became a part of the ISO. Currently, we've been there since 2008.
It's a great partnership.
It is a fantastic partnership. We couldn't have asked for anything better than that. But the premise of the program when we first established it was to give children in the immediate area of the Children's Museum opportunity for stringed instruments. And so I developed this program, which later the Children's Museum accepted. And the emphasis in the program was on, of course, learning how to play music, which is the traditional everybody expects. But the other side of it was to help provide an environment where kids could get to learn about each other. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of it was had a focus on education. And then the other emphasis that we had was the importance of using music as a vehicle to bring families together.
And it was really focused on that neighborhood around the Children's Museum
originally. That was the beginning of it, yes.
Of course, it's grown a lot. But the bringing families together is, I think, one of the most intriguing parts of it because when I think of Metropolitan Youth Orchestra now, I know this wasn't always the case, but you're actually having parents play side by side with their kids. Usually.
Yes, but that was the original intention mm-hmm. also at the Children's Museum, mm-hmm. was to actively get the parents in that community involved in educating of their children.
That's a great element of it. Mm-hmm. It's very cool. And Crystal, you are an alum. I mean, now you're associate director. But tell me a bit about your experience when you were a student.
I started in MYO when I was about sixth or seventh grade. I had already been taking private lessons from my science teacher's daughter. And she just so happened to be MYO's first violin teacher. So she brought me on board. And it was a great experience. It was the first time I'd ever was able to socialize with kids from other schools. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Pike Township, so I only knew everything about Pike. So I started learning about different schools, learning from different people. My best friends come out of MYO, and we still talk to this day.
That's so cool.
A lot of us are still in music. We still teach or play. Mm-hmm. But it was a great experience growing up, especially at the Children's Museum. It was a place that we didn't go to that often. So to be a part of that mm-hmm. every Saturday, where we would all just hang out and eat, and we just became like one big family. Like, that's a huge part of my childhood that I remember.
And you went on to study violin at Butler and then actually went off to New York for a while before you came back here, right? So it's always been a part of your life.
Exactly. I didn't think that I was going to make a career out of music, mm-hmm. But I did. I always kept gravitating back towards it. And later I learned as I got older, I came from a musical family. So that's also kind of in my blood as well.
Betty, tell me a little bit about the growth that you've experienced over the past 20 years. I mean, you mentioned the changes from the Children's Museum to the Symphony, but you've gone from, what, a handful of students to over 200 some now? Is
that
right?
Oh, yes, yes. That growth is it's absolutely mind-boggling. We've gotten to the place where we try to now accommodate as many people as we can, but there were times as the program started to grow at the Children's Museum that we had a waiting list that was about 2 or 3 years in length.
Wow.
And so we have, the ISO has provided so much stability for us, and that even now when families come in, very few of them do leave. And we are trying to make sure that we're reaching communities where children don't really have that option. So we find that we have to take this opportunity to them because they don't know to come to us.
Sure.
And during that period of time, as Crystal was speaking about her experience, we've discovered that we had so many musical geniuses among that group, including Crystal. And we've also found out that we've had children who have been inclined intellectually towards math and science. But if we had not brought them into the program, we never would have discovered it.
Sure.
And they may not even have had an opportunity to realize that that was their gift and that we were able to open up those doors for them. And so now associated with the ISO, those opportunities are endless. I'm so excited about that. We're meeting and making new friends, developing relationships with people who are professionals in different arenas, who are agreeing to mentor our kids, not just musically like our ISO musicians, but also individuals who have found out about MYO
mm-hmm.
and our focus on education, and they're willing to mentor them. If a kid wants to become a doctor, we have some doctors set aside. If they want to become an architect, we have people who are willing to work with them in that regard.
So. No, that's great. And, mm-hmm. and obviously, I mean, it's about strengthening the community, strengthening families.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The intent is not necessarily to create professional musicians, but it sounds like you've had, I mean, as you said, some musical geniuses. I mean, mm-hmm. Crystal, you've done this. Have you had other students who have gone on to become musicians?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, one of Crystal's best friends, who is now in New York, his name is Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
He has replaced Crystal in what she was doing in her program there, the Noel Poynter Foundation. And like she said, they would hang out with me on Saturday
mm-hmm.
all day. And Crystal was my, I'm not Crystal, but Kevin was my hangout buddy.
Nice.
And then, of course, we have young people who have also, like we have one violist who's at Juilliard now. He'll be he's going into his senior year, and he's doing really well for himself. His siblings are going to school for music composition, and we have another young lady who has just contacted me recently, and she's a veterinarian, and she owns her own veterinarian clinic.
That's great.
And she reached out to me, and she says, if anybody wants to go into the field, let me know.
Hmm.
I can help them do that. So
I would imagine it's got to be very exciting for the students, but I would also think it could be very intimidating for the parents to go in and be potentially learning a new instrument at a more advanced age.
Well, they're quite excited about it
mm-hmm.
Because the environment that we try to create for them has to do with learning is about fun. So the environment is very, very invitational. It's something that the parents, they look forward to coming
yeah.
to the rehearsals. And we've had many parents who have thanked us for giving them this opportunity to be able to learn something right alongside with their children.
That's great. And it is a great opportunity.
Yeah, we're at the point now where the parents have taken it upon themselves to create their own parent orchestra.
Hmm.
You know,
that's
so,
really cool.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about the upcoming concerts, because I know you've got, of course, your 20th anniversary concert at the Hilbert Circle Theater. You're also going to be part of Butler's Arts Fest and playing at the Stutz Artist Open House. Crystal?
Well, our big celebration, our 20th anniversary celebration, is April 10, 3:00 p.m. at Hilbert. It's free. open to the public. We want lots of people to come out. It's also our jazz and jam concert.
Yeah, so, it's a jazz concert.
We're going to have collaborations with Kathy Morris, who helped create our first jazz and jam. So she's coming back to give that experience to some of our new kids who didn't have that. We'll have Dean Franca from the ISO as a guest soloist. And we'll have George Smith, longtime music educator and MYO parent, who will be playing as well. So we're going to be playing everything from Ellington to James Brown and debuting a MYO student's composition at the program. So it's going to be a really good time.
And again, that's 3 o'clock on April 10th at the Hilbert, and that's a free concert.
Yes.
Tell me briefly about this original student composition.
One of our students in Orchestra A, Alex McGrath, has composed a piece for the 20th anniversary specifically. It's called MYO Overture. And it kind of incorporates pieces that we've all played over the years it encompasses most of the pieces that we play. So it's a really great piece. It sounds very cinematic, and our top orchestra is going to play that. So we always like to give students that that chance in that area to be able to, you know, showcase their talents.
That'll be a great day. I'm sure lots of alum and parents will come out for that.
Oh, yes.
It'll be a big day. And then also mentioned you'll be at the Butler Arts Fest April 16th, and then the Stutz Artist Open House April 30th. So
yes,
a lot of concerts coming up.
Our chamber orchestra will be at Stutz,
okay.
And Orchestra A and B will be at Butler Arts Fest.
A and B, so you split them up?
Yes, we have A, B, C, and D. D is our youngest group, our beginners, and A is our top group.
Very cool. So what is it like for you now coming back as a associate director, having been an alum and through the program and returning back to Indiana?
It's kind of like a full circle moment.
Yeah.
It's really cool to see the kind of experience people are getting now, to see people go from the time that they're 5 all the way through high school. You know, when we started, we were all pretty much in middle school, high school. So to see it get to a point where we had to add multiple levels and start kids from a very young age and to see them grow up through that is pretty amazing. So,
is there a wait list for people trying to get in, or is
an
application process? I mean, I would imagine.
We actually just released the applications for the 2016-2017 season. We have released applications to those people on the wait list. It is a combination of first come, first serve, as well as serving people who have the most need as well. We want to make sure.
It's not geographic specific anymore, right?
Not at all.
Throughout Marion County.
It's always been pretty much throughout Marion County.
Very cool. Excellent. Betty, you must feel very good about the past 20 years.
I really do. It flew by quickly.
It does.
But to see how, like Crystal said, how it's grown and the impact that we've had on families, that's the most cherishing part for me. And to see so many MYO students coming back and teaching, and then to have their children in the program, that's the most unique experience. It's very difficult to explain. And then, of course, to have Crystal come back with her knowledge, you know, and also to have something in common with her, because I was born in Brooklyn, so so we kind of speak the same Brooklyn talk.
Yes.
But just to know that it's going to be in place even when I'm not around. And I most appreciative to of people recognizing that this program has definitely made an impact on our city. And a lot of people are recognizing that, and they want to be able to help. They want to share about the Metropolitan Youth Orchestra. There are other artists in the city who see our model and want to know how can they use that model to help more kids, because there's a desperate need for it. But also, the other thing about MYO, when we talk about demographics, we specifically did not just target one group of people, because the world is not like that. And we want our children to grow up to be more global in their thinking. So when we look at race, or we look at social economics, when we get all of those people into the music arena, they don't see that. It becomes all about the music, and they see more of how similar they are than they are different. And that's what we strive very hard to get across for them.
Excellent. Well, Betty, Crystal, it's a delight to meet you. Thank you for being here. And Betty, I just want to say congratulations to you on a phenomenal 20 years, and what a great legacy. And thank you for doing this for our community.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Travis DiNicola with Metropolitan Youth Orchestra founder and artistic director Betty Perry and associate director Crystal Ford. MYO will celebrate its 20th anniversary with a free jazz concert at 3 p.m. April 10th at Hilbert Circle Theater. MYO will also perform at Butler University's Arts Fest on April 16th and at the Stutz Artist Open House on April 30th. More information at the Symphony's website, IndianapolisSymphony.org, and then search for MYO. That's short for Metropolitan Youth Orchestra. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Do you have Prince Albert in a can?
Should I let him out?
Yes, you should let him out. He's suffocating in there.
I know why you're asking me that.
Why am I asking you that?
Friday is April Fool's Day.
It's April Fool's Day.
I love April Fool's Day.
It's time to call your local tobacconist and ask if they have Prince Albert in a can.
Let him out.
He's suffocating.
Oh, you know what? I was actually doing some cleaning last weekend, and I picked up this one pen and was trying to figure out if it worked, and I got shocked, totally forgetting. I bought it years ago. It was an electric shock pen. And it hurt. It was a gag pen, and I fooled myself.
Wow.
Yes.
That's frightening.
Okay. Well, on that note, let's go on to that calendar, the no-fooling edition of
What Do We Do?
Okay. Now, really, this, so this is for...
I understand you have something that's rare as can be.
It is rare as can be. And again, this is a reminder that even though this exhibit actually is happening, it is taking place on April Fool's, and it is down at IMOCA at the Murphy Building on Virginia Avenue, and it's Friday night. And Will Higgins has put this together as part of the American Society of Presidential Urine Collectors. And that's right.
Wait, what's that acronym sound like when you sound
I'm not going to make that sound. There will be samples of urine samples from 31 presidents, from James Polk through George W. Bush, apparently missing Gerald Ford's sample. And then there will also be bonus specimens from certain 2016 candidates. This has been curated by Will Higgins and put together, and as I said, the exhibit is actually taking place. The rest of the legitimacy of it is up to you to determine.
I can't wait to see what the vessels holding the liquid look like.
Yes, well, apparently it's all part of a tribute to Dr. Daniel Sloan, who was the house physician for James Polk, who used to take weekly specimens from Polk to understand the president's health better, and he also did leachings and injections of blood from monkeys and such things like that. Polk also, you know, died 3 months after leaving office.
Because he was bled dry from all the samples.
Yep. So apparently Sloan amassed something like 7 gallons of urine from President Polk and then sold it later to the Smithsonian to cover his gambling debts. Some of this I'm not making up. But again, the exhibit... It is an art exhibit of a sort. American Society of Presidential Urine Collectors will be putting this on at IMOCA on Friday night, April Fool's.
Well, then. One of these years, The Art of the Matter is actually going to air on April Fool's Day again, and take heed, dear listeners. All right, my next item is not a joke. It's very, very real. Next weekend, on the 9th and the 10th, the Indiana Artisan Marketplace is back at the Indiana State Fairgrounds, and you can see and taste and sample and buy work by nearly 150 artisans recognized by the state as creating the highest quality art, foods, and beverages in Indiana. Also on view, works by artisans from Kentucky. Their program, which is parallel to Indiana Artisan, is called Kentucky Crafted. And there are more than 100 artisans from Kentucky as well. So just all sorts of wonderful things to look at and buy for yourself, for presents. Think of all those graduations and weddings coming up. Everything from syrups and jams and cheeses to granola, barbecue, salsa, cookies, noodles, candles, chocolates, wines, beers, furniture, et cetera. Oh, my. Find out more and get tickets at IndianaArtisan.org. IndianaArtisan.org. That's next weekend. No fooling.
Sounds great. Hey, a really big book and author event, an annual event, is coming up. The 36th Annual Christomore House Guild book and author benefit luncheon that benefits the Christmore House and the work that they do. It's going to be on April 15th at the Indiana Roof Ballroom. Starts at 10 o'clock and goes till 2, so it is a luncheon. And it is featuring a number of really great authors who will be speaking. You can get books signed and all that sort of stuff, including from a couple of New York Times bestselling authors, Lauren Belfer, Elizabeth Church, Ellen Feldman, Lori King, Nina Sadowski, and Katrina Ann Willis are all going to be authors featured there. And you can still get tickets, and it will be a great event for book lovers. If you go to christamoreguild.org, you can find out more information, or you can check it out on Facebook as well about this. The proceeds from the event benefit their scholarship fund and educational programs offered through Christamore House. April 15th for the Book and Author Luncheon.
Fantastic. This coming Tuesday, April 5th at 7:30 at the Basile Theater at the Indiana Glick History Center, the Ronan Chamber Ensemble's final concert of the season has the theme of Focus on the Violin, and they're hosting Haoming Zhi, 2010 Laureate of the International Violin International Violin Competition of Indianapolis, easy for me to say, in music from duos all the way up to a nonet of winds and strings music by Khachaturian, Chausson, Tchaikovsky, Louis Spohr, and, as they say, many, many more. You can find out more about that by typing R-O-N-E-N, Chamber Ensemble, into a search engine. But again, that's coming up this coming Tuesday, 7:30 at the Indiana History Center.
Well, we lost a great Indiana jazz musician and educator this week when David Baker passed. He was an amazing man and an incredible influence on pretty much every jazz musician within the city and state and beyond. So I think it'd be a great week to go check out some jazz. And Jazz Kitchen has some great concerts coming up this weekend. On Friday, Count Basie Big Band. On Saturday, Jazz Kitchen's 22nd anniversary with the Steve Ali Big Band is going to be playing. And then on Sunday, they're having their Sunday Jazz Brunch. And that should be a lot of fun, too. So three great concerts this weekend at the Jazz Kitchen. Great way to pay tribute to the incredible David Baker.
Fantastic. Hey, don't forget there's a whole a variety of events going on this weekend as part of the Before I Die Festival, including an art opening at the Stutz, the Raymond James Stutz Arts Gallery, in the Stutz building on this Friday night, April 1st, no fooling. Also a writer's workshop coming up on April 5th, Death Cafe on April 15th, and many, many more. Just go to your search engine and type in Before I Die Festival Indy and find out all kinds of fascinating events that are full of good cheer.
Excellent.
Yeah.
No fooling.
No fooling.
Well, Sharon, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to our No Fooling edition next week of
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Hoosiers know Booth Tarkington as the author of novels like The Magnificent Ambersons, Alice Adams, and Penrod, but he was also a sophisticated art collector, as Sharon Gamble recently discovered. The Indianapolis Museum of Art has opened A Gentleman from Indiana, Portraits from the Collection of Booth Tarkington. And Sharon Gamble spoke with guest curator Jacqueline Coudray to learn about his collection.
People in Indiana, especially in Indianapolis, know Booth Tarkington as an author. but maybe not as an art collector. How did the idea of this exhibit come about, and what is the source of the works in the collection?
Well, I was working at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, looking at a portrait of Franz Hals. And there was a very pithy quote that Tarkington made about the painting in 1937. He said that Hals, at that time it was thought to be a self-portrait, Hals painted himself without the faintest touch of vanity. And I just thought it was such a poetic way to think about this figure that I dug a bit further and found out that Tarkington was involved in organizing this really fundamental exhibition of Dutch painting that put the precursor to the IMA, the John Heron Art Institute, on the map worldwide as a major source of old master paintings.
Indeed.
So it was a wonderful way for me to get at Tarkington as a collector and see his role at the museum as well.
And that quotation that you just gave us suggests that he was not just a collector, but had thought deeply about painting. Did he paint himself? Did he have some inside sort of understanding of the process?
He absolutely did, and I think that's one of the great things about this exhibition. It represents about 10 of the drawings that he made during his university years. He began drawing as a child. He writes in the early 1940s that he would cover his notebooks with sketches, and he was always slightly distracted during his classes because he was busy doodling, as we all are wont to do. But James Whitcomb Riley would actually come to his home. He was quite good friends with Tarkington's older sister, Mary. And Riley would offer him advice on sketching and drawing. And in fact, his first published drawing was on the cover of one of Riley's books. And so it progressed from there. He ended up taking courses with T.C. Steele, with an illustrator at Purdue University, but he confesses that he recognized that his talent was not sufficient to allow him to pursue a career in the visual arts. So he opted for composed lines rather than painted ones, shall we say.
Without that self-knowledge, we would have had a very different literary history in Indiana and beyond.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So painting is one thing, being able to draw or paint as well as appreciate the human form, that's a pretty specialized area within art.
That is correct, yes. And I think it certainly informed his collecting, going back to the 16th and 17th centuries when theorists began to write about collecting and being able to distinguish quality amongst different paintings. They really privileged the idea of having firsthand knowledge of how to paint and draw in order to refine the eye. And I think Tarkington really marshaled his experience with the visual arts and used it to make him a rather sophisticated collector.
Did he leave his collection to the IMA, or was this show put together by tracking down works in different individuals' collections?
All of the works in the show come from the IMA's collection, but very few of them were given directly by Tarkington to the John Heron Art Institute. He only gave, if I recall correctly, 4 works to the institute. The majority of the works that were in his collection came through his widow, who gave them over the course of the remaining 20 years of her life after he had passed away.
Mm-hmm. And you had, for your research, all kinds of correspondence with art dealers, right?
Correct, yes.
And so he was pretty serious about this. So he had some Dutch portraits. Any particular painters he was especially fond of?
In the Dutch portrait category, he was a big fan of an artist who is not as popular today as earlier in the 20th century, Willem Wissing. He also had portraits in his collection by Gerard Honthorst. And I'm trying to still track down the actual portrait itself, but there was one by the Dutch artist Meindert Hommaba.
And do we have any sense of why he was attracted to did he have Dutch heritage, or there was just something about the styles of particular painters who happened to be Dutch that he was fascinated by?
I think he was primarily drawn to British portraits of the 18th century, and much of that tradition looks back to Northern European painting of the 17th century.
And so this is an era where the portraits are fairly formal. They're not candids the way today's contemporary painters might paint, right?
Correct, yes.
And I can't imagine that this would be true, but did you find any evidence whatsoever that any of these portraits inspired his writing?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. And that's why I find him to be such a fascinating person. He wrote several things about his love of art and collecting, most famously his Some Old Portraits of 1939. It's an entire book of reflections upon his portrait collection.
Wow.
A few years earlier, he published his Rumbin Galleries, which is a fascinating, almost expose of the art world. It focuses on a dealer of kind of mysterious Eastern European origins and kind of the different ways in which he angles to sell paintings to different collectors.
Whoa. And it's an expose.
It is. And it's delightful. And so much of the language that you hear in the art world is represented in the novel. So it really demonstrates how in touch he was in terms of trying to place a painting with a specific collector and the importance of provenance, et cetera. He was incredibly knowledgeable about these things and incorporated them his knowledge very subtly into these works.
It's also going to make me go back and read, say, The Magnificent Ambersons after I come look at the portraits in this collection and say, I wonder if this portrait inspired this woman.
Could very well be. I think that's why he was so interested in portraiture. He said that art is what tells man about himself. And, of course, his characters are so well developed in his writings that I think he saw portraits as a visual reflection of what he explored in his writings, kind of the psychological impact of each individual person and the story behind their lives.
The painting is its own novel. If you stand there and look at it long enough, you create your own backstory for whoever the person in the portrait is.
Absolutely, and I know that that's what he was doing.
Wow. Did he collect his contemporaries at all?
He was rather conservative in his taste. I mentioned the painting by Guy Pendubois earlier. That is an example of one contemporary portrait that he collected. Mm-hmm. He did patronize Wayman Adams. Willem Rubin was another Indiana artist that he patronized. But in terms of the great avant-garde artists that were being collected in Europe and in the U.S. at that point, Picasso, Matisse, he was not so excited about them.
That's not surprising. It seems to keep with his style, collecting something a little bit more conservative. Did anything that you found in this, in the process of putting this exhibition together, surprise you about Mr. Tarkington?
Well, I guess I didn't realize how deep his connection was to his art historical peers, shall we say. He actually was a good friend of Erwin Panofsky, who was one of the great, shall we say, founders of the practice of art history in the United States. And they came to know each other in Kennebunkport, where Tarkington had a summer home, and they developed this fast friendship, and he actually looked to Panofsky for advice about how to characterize art objects in his work. And it was just a very surprising connection between the field of art history and the world of literature with which we normally associate Tarkington.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Do you have a favorite in the collection?
I have to say that I am in love with the portrait by Rayburn. I just find that it is so compelling. It demonstrates the way that he can characterize a forceful personality, but do so with individuality and with great painterliness.
So what do you want people who've come to see this exhibition to take away with them as far as how they feel about Booth Tarkington?
Well, he is such a presence in Indianapolis, isn't he, with the theater and the neighborhood and the public school. But I feel like after all these years, we're beginning to see even a new aspect of him that we never even conceived of. Someone who was heavily involved in the world of art, but also helped really to form and shape the current IMA, somebody who was fundamental in that. So I think not only in terms of his collecting and the works that he gave to the JHAI, but also to the direction that he gave to the museum, was fundamental and reveals a whole new side of the author.
Sharon Gamble with IMA guest curator Jacqueline Coudray. You can see A Gentleman from Indiana, Portraits from the Collection of Booth Tarkington, at the Indianapolis Museum of Art through February 26th of next year. And you can get more information at imamuseum.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out about the upcoming Peacemakers concert.
I'll talk with Mark Zalonis about his long tenure as the IMA's Deputy Director of Environmental Affairs and Historic Preservation.
And I'll talk with author Pete Ferry. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.